content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 10th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Iran nuclear talks go to the wire. What happened? Talks between Iran and six world powers continued beyond their deadline this week as the two sides battled over key details of a preliminary deal to curb the Islamic regime's nuclear capabilities. As the week went to press, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and representatives from Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia had decided to extend talks with Iranian negotiators in Lausanne, Switzerland, for a second day beyond the self-imposed deadline. Their goal was to forge the basic outlines of an agreement that could be hammered into a more detailed treaty at the end of June. "I think we have a broad framework of understanding," said British Foreign Minister Philip Hammond, "but there are still some key issues that have to be worked through." Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif said that the U.S. and other nations had to decide whether to engage with Iran based on respect or whether they want to continue based on pressure. Central among the unresolved issues was Tehran's demand for economic sanctions imposed by the United Nations to be lifted immediately, a condition resisted by the U.S. and its European partners, who wanted the sanctions eased gradually as Iran proved its compliance. Other sticking points included constraints on Iran's nuclear research, the transfer of large stockpiles of its atomic fuel to Russia, and limitations on production capacity at its heavy water reactor at Arak. What the editorial said: "President Obama is pursuing a mirage," said the Washington Times. "He is convinced a détente with Tehran will somehow put an end to the strife in the Middle East, giving him the grand foreign policy legacy to justify his unearned Nobel Peace Prize. So he and Secretary of State John Kerry have offered concessions on all the major issues, including allowing Iran to continue to operate thousands of state-of-the-art centrifuges. Our feckless commander-in-chief's foreign policy legacy will be cheered only in Tehran. No agreement can guarantee Iran doesn't get the bomb," said BloombergView.com. "But a reasonable goal is to keep Iran's nuclear program at least a year away from the capability to build one, so that if the regime reneges and tries to build weapons, we'll have time to act. Still, Iran's refusal to permit intrusive inspections at all nuclear sites does not bode well," said The Economist. "International inspectors are sure that Iran did work on bomb development in the past. Even if a tentative agreement can be reached, it will mean nothing if we cannot be sure Iran isn't operating clandestine nuclear facilities." What the columnist said: "The choice is not between a bad deal or war," said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "The real alternative to caving in to Iran is to double down on tough economic sanctions. That would bring Iran's economy to its knees, forcing the mullahs to accept an agreement that, unlike the one currently being negotiated, would actually stop them from building a bomb." "What nonsense," said Roger Cohen in the New York Times. "Anyone who knows anything about Iran knows that it is a proud nation that would rather starve than cave. Iran's population is largely young, aspirational, and eager to engage with the West. It would be foolish to alienate them and empower the most radical factions in Tehran." "No deal will ever be good enough for the right," said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Conservatives have angrily opposed every major negotiation with an American adversary since World War II, including Richard Nixon's opening to China and Ronald Reagan's nuclear arms agreement with the Soviets. Ultimately, the right believes that war is the only answer to evil regimes and that all leaders are either Winston Churchill-style heroes or Neville Chamberlain-style appeasers. The great unknown is Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Any agreement with Iran will require the Supreme Leader's approval, and no one knows where Khamenei really stands. He said he wanted a deal and to see Iran enter the global economy, yet continues to spout anti-American slogans. Iran's Islamic Revolution was based on opposition to America, and he has to fear that excessive détente with the West might trigger slow-motion regime change. Is he willing to take that risk? Our controversy of the week, Indiana. Is religious freedom an excuse to discriminate? Poor, misunderstood Mike Pence. Never saw this coming, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Indiana's Republican governor insists that when he signed his state's new Religious Freedom Restoration Act last week, he never dreamed that the act might be interpreted as giving legal cover to anti-gay discrimination. The law, which states that the government may not substantially burden the religious convictions of any individual or business, was clearly a response to the legalization of same-sex marriage, and it triggered a nationwide uproar. The CEOs of huge corporations, including Apple, Eli Lilly, and Walmart, have denounced the law. And businesses, organizations, and liberal cities and states are boycotting Indiana. The NCAA has hinted it may even stop hosting tournaments in the basketball-crazy state. Pence has since pledged to fix the vaguely worded law, said the Indianapolis Star in an editorial. But merely tweaking the legalese won't be enough. The world needs to hear the clear message that our state will not tolerate discrimination against any of its citizens. Pence knew exactly what he was signing, said Garrett Epps in TheAtlantic.com. Defenders of the law protest that it's modeled closely on the federal religious freedom law President Clinton signed in 1993, and that similar laws exist in 19 other states. But this is deeply disingenuous. Most of those other laws protect the religious customs of individuals from intrusion by the government. The Indiana law, which Pence signed before an approving crowd of gay marriage opponents, has been carefully written to enable businesses to claim a religious exception if accused of discrimination by individuals. That would enable a Christian baker, say, to refuse to make a wedding cake for a gay couple on the grounds of religious freedom. The law is so vaguely worded that it could be used to justify almost any act of discrimination on religious grounds, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. If a restaurant owner's religion teaches that homosexuality is an abomination, he could hang a no gays allowed sign in the window. Muslim-owned stores could refuse to serve unveiled women. Is it any wonder that people are outraged? The liberal backlash is a perfect storm of hysteria and legal ignorance, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Indiana's law merely states that defendants can raise the issue of their religion in defending themselves from lawsuits. It doesn't mandate that they win, and in other states with similar laws, they often lose. The theatrical outrage over the law isn't really rooted in fear of discrimination, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. With gay marriage sweeping the land faster than anyone expected, its supporters now demand unconditional surrender. Observant Christians and Jews are being told to abandon traditional sexual morality altogether or be treated with the same contempt as racists who fought for Jim Crow laws. In a rapidly changing society, what kind of space, if any, will be left to religious conservatives now? Asked Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. Will government seek to revoke the tax-exempt status of any church, religious school, or university that teaches that homosexuality is sinful and that marriage is a sacred union of a man and a woman? Will society seek to punish and eradicate these views, the way it sought to eradicate racial discrimination? These are not merely rhetorical questions. We Christian conservatives want to know what comes next. Once the florist and bakers have been appropriately fined and closed down. Well, it was a good week for budding businesses after country music legend Willie Nelson revealed plans to open a line of legal marijuana stores featuring his own artisanal brand of weed to be called Willie's Reserve. It was a good week for exculpatory evidence after a UCLA researcher found that, despite persistent beliefs to the contrary, the phases of the moon have no discernible effect on hospital admissions, births, or criminal activity. The moon is innocent, said the researcher. It was a good week for playing catch with your kid after an analysis revealed that the average salary for Major League Baseball players would be a record $4.25 million on opening day 2015. But it was a bad week for riding shotgun after a Washington State motorist was busted in the carpool lane alongside a cardboard cutout of Dos Equis beer, Most Interesting Man. After issuing a citation, the state trooper tweeted, "I don't always violate the HOV lane law, but when I do, I get a $124 ticket." It was a bad week for nervous late arrivals after newly disclosed documents revealed the TSA's checklist for identifying potential terrorists. Warning signs include excessive blinking and yawning, pale cheeks because of a recently shaved beard, and arriving late for a flight. And it was a bad week for know-it-alls after Yale researchers found that using internet search engines leads people to believe they are much smarter than they actually are. When people are truly on their own, said the study author, they may be wildly inaccurate about how much they know and how dependent they are on the internet. Turn now to the briefing page. The Grand Shiite-Sunni Struggle. With old regimes crumbling, Shiites and Sunnis are battling for dominance throughout the Middle East. Why is the Middle East in turmoil? In a half dozen nations, tyrants who once ruled by fear and repression have been toppled, unleashing centuries-old sectarian rivalries and bloody struggles for power. Syria's horrific civil war is spilling into Lebanon and threatening Jordan and Turkey, while Iraq has effectively devolved into three nations, one Shiite, one Sunni, one Kurdish. In the chaos, a particularly malignant form of radical Sunni Islam, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, has seized large swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq. Now Yemen has erupted into yet another civil war that has drawn in forces from the whole region. Each conflict has many local causes, including complex tribal rivalries and a struggle over oil. But underlying them all is the new great game for dominance between the Sunnis and Shiites. The largest Shiite state, Iran, is spreading its influence by funding and arming militias throughout the region, while the largest Sunni state, Saudi Arabia, is now countering by organizing a joint Arab defense force of 40,000 elite troops from Sunni nations. Since Israel's creation in 1948, the Arab-Israeli problem has almost been synonymous with the Middle East problem, says political scientist Michael Gunter. Now, though, the Sunni-Shia split is the main catalyst driving events. Why is that rivalry raging now? It has fueled conflict and repression since the dawn of Islam in the 7th century, but was ignited into a bonfire in 2003. That's when the U.S. overthrew the Sunni-dominated regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Hussein had long brutally suppressed Iraq's Shiite majority, and his fall turned that power dynamic on its head. The new Shiite-dominated government of Nouri al-Maliki marginalized Iraq's Sunnis, denying them any real voice in the new national government. Sunnis rebelled, and al-Qaeda and other extremist Sunni groups joined in the attempt to divide Iraq. In the ensuing bloodbath, both Sunnis and Shiites committed scores of atrocities that killed tens of thousands and deepened animosity between the two sects. The Persian Shiites of Iran, meanwhile, seized on the chance to ally with the Shiites in southern Iraq and gained regional influence. All these events served as a powerful lesson for Iraq's Arab neighbors. What did they learn? They saw that even the most fearsome dictators could be driven from power. Beginning in 2010, the uprisings of the Arab Spring toppled dictators in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt, and helped to spark the ongoing war in Syria. Unfortunately, these revolutions did not lead to democracy and freedom, but instead to chaos, repression by new power brokers, and growing influence for Iran. What is Iran's agenda? Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution that transformed Iran into a Shiite theocracy, the Ayatollahs have sought to strengthen Shiite minorities across the Arab world. Shiites make up only about 15% of Muslims worldwide, but they are a majority in the oil-rich areas of Iran and Iraq, and have significant minorities in Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen. Iran has become a de facto partner of Iraq's Shiite-led government, training 100,000 Shiite militiamen to defend against ISIS and Sunni insurgents. Iran is also meddling in Syria, providing critical support to buttress Bashar al-Assad's regime, which is Alawite, a Shiite splinter sect. And now Iran has encroached on Saudi Arabia's backyard, Yemen, by providing funding and other support to Yemen's Houthis, who are Zaydis, another Shiite splinter sect. Alarmed by Iran's advance, the Saudis last week intervened in Yemen's civil war, bombing Houthi positions and massing 150,000 troops on the border. This is the first example of the Saudis pushing back physically against a Shia insurgency and, by extension, Iran, said John Jenkins, the executive director for International Institute for Strategic Studies, Middle East. Who is the U.S. backing? That depends on the venue. Saudi Arabia has long been a major U.S. ally, and in Syria, the U.S. and the Saudis are on the same side, providing some support to Sunnis rebelling against Assad. In Iraq, though, the U.S. finds itself tacitly allied with Iran, as both support the Iraqi regime in the struggle against ISIS. The Saudis and other Sunnis are deeply worried by the Obama administration's outreach to Iran, especially if a nuclear deal leads to the lifting of sanctions. A lot of the Gulf countries feel they are being thrown under the bus, said Mishal al-Girgawi, a commentator in the United Arab Emirates. Saudi King Salman recently met with the presidents of Egypt and Turkey, the two Sunni states with the most military muscle, to discuss uniting against the Iranian threat. The new great game, it appears, has just begun, and years of chaos and violent conflict appear inevitable. In the 20th century, each state had its own one-man show, said Uzi Rabi, an expert on the region at Tel Aviv University. We are on a journey to an unknown chapter in the Middle East. ISIS, a cult without allies. Though most Mideast rebel groups are allied with either Saudi Arabia or Iran, ISIS stands alone. The self-proclaimed caliphate has embraced an extremist medieval form of Sunni Islam in which Shiites, as well as Yazidis, Christians, and all other infidels, can be justifiably slaughtered. Shiite Iran naturally sees ISIS as a direct threat. But even Sunni Saudi Arabia is horrified by the jihadist group's rise, a great irony given that the seeds for ISIS's ideology were sown by the extreme Wahhabi Salafist form of Islam that Saudi Arabia has supported, funded, and exported for decades. ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is no fan of the U.S.-allied Saudi monarchy, calling it the head of the snake and the stronghold of disease. This gives ISIS quite a list of enemies. The Saudis, Iran, Syria, Turkey, Egypt, the U.S., and the nations of the European Union. ISIS, says F. Gregory Gauss of the Brookings Institution, has the unique ability to unite most of the players in the new Middle East against it. In the long run, that makes the terrorist group unlikely to survive the struggle for control of the region. And we move on to the columns. This from Jackson Deal at the Washington Post. Obama's earthquake on Israel. President Obama may have given up on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said Jackson Deal, but he hasn't given up on accelerating the timetable for Palestinian statehood. Obama is now considering triggering an earthquake in U.S.-Israeli relations by submitting to the U.N. a resolution declaring Palestine a state. The resolution, which has already been drafted but has not been publicly released, would probably stipulate that Palestine's territory be based on Israel's pre-1967 borders, with some land swaps in the West Bank for existing Jewish settlements. Jerusalem would be declared the capital of both nations. But the U.S. would also stipulate that Israel remain the homeland of the Jewish people, a concession that Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas has refused to make. Why go forward with a text that both sides would spurn? Obama hopes it would win unanimous support from the Security Council and stand as a framework for future settlement years from now. Being remembered by history as the grandfather of that breakthrough would give Obama the Mideast legacy he has craved since his first day in office. Before we leave this page, I'm going to give you a quick blurb from the It Must Be True, I Read It in the Tabloids section. A Russian businesswoman has been jailed after she tried to organize a hit on her son's wife, who had irritated her by making nonstop mother-in-law jokes. Tatiana Kudinova, 50, began feuding with her daughter-in-law, Roxanne, over who should pick up the tab for a family party. After that argument, Roxanne kept on joking about her skinflint mother-in-law, and Kudinova hired a hitman to kill her. But the hitman turned out to be an undercover policeman, and she was sentenced to 9 years in prison. A column from the United Kingdom. This comes from Lee Moon at The Guardian. Where foxes are still being torn apart. Most people assume fox hunting ended when it was outlawed a decade ago, said Lee Moon. Not so. The hunt clubs have simply ignored the ban. Every week, horse riders dressed in ridiculous red coats and beige breeches gallop through the countryside, following packs of hounds that are trained to chase down foxes and rip them apart alive. Police and prosecutors simply can't be bothered to interrupt these upper-class brutes in their bloody pleasure. That's why I and others like me devote our weekends to sabotaging the hunts. SABs, as we're known, use nonviolent direct action, such as blowing horns or spreading false scents to disrupt the hunts. Contrary to the crazy propaganda that some hunters put out, we don't spray chemicals at the dogs, or stab the horses, or string piano wire between trees to slice the riders. We don't want anyone to be hurt, including the hunters, even though they often meet us with violence. I have been punched, kicked, spat on, and beaten with sticks while sabbing. If Prime Minister David Cameron holds a parliamentary vote to repeal the ban, as he claims he will if reelected in May, our numbers will only increase. As long as people kill for sport, there will be saboteurs. And an international column, How They See Us, naming Venezuela as an enemy. South America is uniting behind Venezuela in the face of U.S. aggression, said Eduardo Paz Rada in Bold Press from Bolivia. The U.S. imperialist policy has revealed itself through President Obama's recent decision to label Venezuela as an official threat to U.S. security. Obama put sanctions on 7 Venezuela officials, absurdly accusing them of human rights violations, and wider economic sanctions are sure to follow. The 12-country Union of South American Nations immediately and unanimously called for the measures to be revoked. The late Venezuelan leader, Hugo Chavez, predicted this day would come, and fortunately he laid the groundwork for Venezuela's defense that his successor, Nicolas Maduro, is now following. Venezuela is undergoing a massive military mobilization, and it will not stand alone. Bolivia, Argentina, and other nations across the continent are ready to demonstrate solidarity with and support for the Venezuelan people. It looks like Venezuela is the new Cuba, said Gina Montana in El Mundo. At the very moment when the U.S. is rejecting the old Cold War model for relations with Havana, it is applying that model to Caracas. And the Venezuelans are milking their newfound status for all it's worth. Maduro railed that the sanctions were the most aggressive, the most unjust, and most terrible action the U.S. has taken, and warned his citizens that invasion was imminent. Of course, not a shot has been fired, excluding those fired by the National Bolivarian Police against opposition protesters. But Maduro can use the White House's decision to label Venezuela a threat to rally his people against Yankee imperialism and further crack down on the opposition. Actually, Venezuela is a threat to U.S. security, but not for the reasons listed in Obama's executive order, said Carlos Alberto Montaner in El Diario. Exterior from Spain. The president cited human rights abuses and the repression of the political opposition, but those sins were just the excuse for the sanctions. The real problem is the Maduro regime's involvement in drug smuggling and money laundering, and reports that some of its ill-gotten cash is being funneled to Islamic militants backed by Venezuela's ally, Iran. The White House knows all this in detail. So where do we go from here, asks Americo Martin in Tahlequah from Venezuela. Maduro preaches war, but nobody serious believes that the U.S. Marines are about to land on our beaches. Even Maduro must not believe it, because instead of rallying the troops to take up arms, he has ordered them to sign a petition calling for the repeal of sanctions. He intends to deliver this frightening document to Obama next month at the Summit of the Americas. Ink, yes. Bullets, no. This is no drama. This is a sitcom. And we take a look now at the last word, the lasting price of shame. Monica Lewinsky barely survived her humiliation, said Jessica Bennett. Now she's teaching what she learned. Monica Lewinsky was sitting in a Manhattan auditorium several weeks ago watching teenage girls perform a play called Slut. She was wiping away tears. In the scene, a young woman was seated in an interrogation room. She had been asked to describe repeatedly what had happened on the night in question when she said a group of guy friends had pinned her down in a taxi on the way to a party and sexually assaulted her. She had reported them. Now everyone at school knew. Everyone had chosen a side. My life has just completely fallen apart, the girl said, her voice shaking. Now I'm that girl. The play concluded, and Lewinsky fumbled through her purse for a tissue. A woman came and whisked her to the stage. Hi, I'm Monica Lewinsky, she said, visibly nervous. Some of the younger people might only know me from some rap lyrics. The crowd, made up largely of high school and college women, laughed. Monica Lewinsky is the title of a song by rapper G-Eazy. Her name is a reference in dozens of others by Kanye, Beyoncé, and Eminem. Thank you for coming, Lewinsky said. And in doing so, standing up against the sexual scapegoating of women and girls. Asked later about the play, Lewinsky said, it's really inspiring to hear people bring awareness to this issue. That scene in the interrogation room was hard to watch. One thing I've learned about trauma is that when you find yourself re-triggered, it's helpful to recognize when things are different. A lot is different for Lewinsky these days, starting with the fact that until last year she had hardly appeared publicly for a decade. Now 41, the former White House intern, once famously dismissed by the president as that woman, holds a master's degree in social psychology from the London School of Economics. She splits her time between New York City and Los Angeles, where she grew up, and London, and said it's been hard to find work. Mostly she has embraced a quiet existence, doing meditation and therapy, volunteering, spending time with friends. But the quiet ended last May when she wrote an essay for Vanity Fair about the aftermath of her affair with President Bill Clinton. In this essay, which was the finalist for a 2015 National Magazine Award, she declared that the time had come to burn the beret and bury the blue dress and give a purpose to my past. That new purpose, she wrote, was twofold. It was about reclaiming her own story, one that had seemed to metastasize, but also to help others who had been similarly humiliated. What this will cost me, she wrote, I will soon find out. It hasn't appeared to cost her, at least not yet. In fact, the opposite has occurred. Over the past 6 months, she has made appearances at a benefit hosted by the Norman Mailer Center. She and Mailer had been friends. At a New York Fashion Week dinner presentation for designer Rachel Comey, at the Vanity Fair Oscar party, and as her friend Alan Cummings' date as an after-party for the Golden Globes. Perhaps most interestingly, in October, on stage at a Forbes conference, she spoke out for the first time about the digital harassment, or cyberbullying, that has affected everyone from female bloggers to Jennifer Lawrence to her. I lost my reputation. I was publicly identified as someone I didn't recognize, and I lost my sense of self, she told the crowd. She just took that declaration one step further last month on the main stage at TED in Vancouver, British Columbia, where she issued a biting cultural critique about humiliation as commodity. The title of her 18-minute talk, and perhaps the line that best sums up her experience, which received a raucous standing ovation, was "The Price of Shame." This is not Lewinsky's first attempt at reinvention. She's also not the Lewinsky of more than a decade ago, the one who created a handbag line and tried her hand at reality TV. This iteration is a bundle of contradictions, warm yet cautious, open yet guarded, strong but fragile. She is likable, funny, and self-deprecating. She is acutely intelligent, something for which she doesn't get much credit. But she is also stuck in a kind of time warp over which she has little control. At 41, she doesn't have many of the things that a person of her age may want: a permanent residence, an obvious source of income, a clear career path. She is also very, very nervous. She is worried about being taken advantage of, worried her words will be misconstrued, worried reporters will rehash the past. She is prepared almost always for doomsday. The sniper of a quote that might be taken out of context, questions about the Clintons, whom she declines to discuss. She was burned in myriad ways, said her editor at Vanity Fair, David Friend. Lewinsky wouldn't call this a reinvention. This, she says, is simply the Monica who, despite the headlines, despite the incessant paparazzi-style coverage, was seen by many but truly known by few, as she put it on the TED stage. "This is me," she told me. "This is a kind of evolution of me." I had approached her after the Vanity Fair essay, in part because I was intrigued, but also because I had a tinge of guilt. I had come of age in the Lewinsky era. I distinctly remember my high school self, wide-eyed, poring over the softcore Star Report with friends. None of us had the maturity to understand the complexities or power dynamics of the president's affair with a young intern. When I was 16, one dominating image of Lewinsky seemed to overshadow all the others. Slut. Of course, that 22-year-old intern was only a few years older than I was. And so I emailed her. I told her I was interested in her effort to reemerge and had been particularly fascinated by the reaction to it, as if there were a kind of public reckoning underway. Feminists who had stayed silent on the first go-round were suddenly defending her and using terms like slut-shaming and media gender bias to do it. Late-night host David Letterman was on the air expressing remorse over how he had mocked her, asking in a recent interview with Barbara Walters, "With some perspective, do you realize this is a sad human situation?" Bill Maher said of reading Lewinsky's piece in Vanity Fair, "I got to tell you, I literally felt guilty." However you feel about the actual event, the way it played out was pretty grotesque, said Rebecca Traister, a senior editor at the New Republic, who was just out of college when the Clinton scandal broke and who wrote about it later. Traister said she was taken aback when she reread her own 2003 article, "Get Off Your Knees, Monica." Whether it's guilt or sophistication or thinking a little harder about sexual power dynamics, I think people have started to think, oh, right, she probably does have a right to tell her story. And that's a good thing. This time, Lewinsky appears determined to tell it on her terms. She has a PR agent screening requests and approaches media as one might expect, with the caution of a woman who has been raked over the coals. I met Lewinsky at her apartment, where she was rehearsing her TED speech in front of a small metal music stand. She handed me a script. "It's changed a bit, so you can follow along," she said. By the time she appeared on stage at TED, in front of a packed room, she was on version 24. She was working through the middle of the speech, where she would describe her questioning by investigators. It was 1998, and she had been required to authenticate the phone calls recorded by her former friend, Linda Tripp. They would later be released to Congress. She glanced at the script and then looked forward. Scared and mortified, I listened, she said. Listen to my sometimes catty, sometimes churlish, sometimes silly self, being cruel, unforgiving, uncouth. Listen, deeply, deeply ashamed to the worst version of myself. She paused. A self I don't even recognize. Lewinsky doesn't have a speechwriter. She wrote the speech herself. She went back and forth over the opening, a joke about a man 14 years her junior who hit on her after she spoke at Forbes. What was his unsuccessful pickup line? She would ask rhetorically. He could make me feel 22 again. Later that night, I realized I'm probably the only person over 40 who would not like to be 22 again. Can I see a show of hands, she would ask, of anyone who didn't make a mistake or do something they regretted at 22? Ted approached Lewinsky about speaking at the conference, whose theme this year was Truth and Dare, after watching her Forbes speech. The speech's theme had been marinating for years. In graduate school, Lewinsky had studied the impact of trauma on identity. Then Tyler Clementi, a Rutgers freshman, killed himself after being recorded by his college roommate being intimate with a man. It was 2010, and Lewinsky's mother was beside herself, gutted with pain, as Lewinsky said on stage, in a way I couldn't quite understand. Eventually, she said, she realized that to her mother, Clementi represented her. She was reliving 1998, she said, looking out over the crowd, reliving a time when she sat by my bed every night, reliving a time when she made me shower with the bathroom door open. It was easy to forget, she said, that that woman was dimensional, had a soul, and was once unbroken. The way Lewinsky tells it, she was patient zero for the type of internet shaming which we now see regularly. Hers wasn't the first case ever, but it was the first of its magnitude, which meant that virtually overnight she went from being a private citizen to, as she put it, a publicly humiliated one. She couldn't go to a restaurant and order a bowl of soup, literally, without it being reported the next day, said Walters. The story was the perfect combination of politics and sex. It was like reading a really wonderful dirty book, Walters said, except it was her story. It was before the days of the internet sex tape, but barely. Princess Diana had been photographed with a hidden camera while working out at the gym. Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee's honeymoon sex tape was stolen from their home and bootlegged out of car trunks. It was at the tip of the spear of this invasive culture, said David Friend. Lewinsky was quickly cast by the media as a little tart, as the Wall Street Journal put it. The New York Post nicknamed her the portly pepper pot. She was described by Maureen Dowd in the New York Times as ditzy and predatory. And other women, self-proclaimed feminist, piled on. My dental hygienist pointed out she had third-stage gum disease, said Erica Jong. Betty Friedan dismissed her as some little twerp. It's a sexual shaming that is far more directed at women than at men, Gloria Steinem wrote me in an email, noting that in Lewinsky's case, she was also targeted by the ultra-right wing. I'm grateful to her, Steinem said, for having the courage to return to the public eye. Earlier, I had asked Lewinsky what she hoped to accomplish with a platform like TED. She asked if I had read David Foster Wallace's brief interviews with hideous men. In it, there is a chapter about suffering and the story of a girl who survives abuse. What the young woman endures is horrific, said Lewinsky, but by going through it, she learns that she can survive. That's part of what I thought I could contribute, she said. That in someone else's darkest moment, lodged in their subconscious, might be the knowledge that there was someone else who, at one point in time, the most humiliated person in the world, and that she survived it. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. On the Health and Science page, Jupiter's Path of Creative Destruction. Earth may owe its existence to the planet Jupiter. New research suggests that the giant gaseous planet played a key role in the formation of the solar system by barreling through it like a cosmic wrecking ball, destroying existing planets and creating debris that coalesced into new ones, including ours. Astronomers began developing this theory after finding that virtually all of the solar systems they observed around the other stars have giant rocky planets orbiting their suns at a very close range, closer than Mercury is to our sun. Our solar system is looking increasingly like an oddball, study co-author Gregory Laughlin tells NationalGeographic.com. His team modeled a scenario in which our solar system originally had giant planets close to the sun, with Jupiter a bit further out than it is today. The model showed that the sun's gravity would have pulled Jupiter into closer orbit, causing it to collide with other planetary bodies, resulting in a collisional cascade that eventually obliterated the other giants. Jupiter's inward path was eventually reversed by the formation of Saturn, which had sufficient gravity to pull the gas giant back away from the sun. The planetary debris left in Jupiter's wake served as the building blocks for Earth, Mercury, Venus, and Mars. Laughlin concedes this theory is unproven, but says it could explain why the inner part of our solar system is just missing. Possum's natural antivenom. Scientists have known for decades that possums are largely immune to snake bite. Now they know why. And the discovery could help save thousands of snake bite victims every year. Possum blood contains a peptide scientists are calling lethal toxin neutralizing factor, or LTNF. Scientists isolated the peptide and injected it into mice exposed to several venomous snakes, including the deadly diamondback rattlesnake. In all cases, the treatment protected the mice from the venom. Researchers speculate that the peptide works by binding to a toxic protein in the venom, rendering it harmless. It is almost not reasonable that the peptide alone neutralized rattlesnake venom, study author Claire Comives tells NationalGeographic.com, but that is what happened. Possum antivenom, which could be produced at a lower cost and in large quantities, also protected against venomous scorpions and some toxic plants without negative side effects. Comives says the peptide works so well against all natural poisons that it's like a miracle. And the health scare of the week, the price of cheap wine. Over the past decade, Trader Joe's has sold about 600 million bottles of its discount wine, affectionately dubbed Two-Buck Chuck. But a pending class action lawsuit now alleges that drinking the bargain brand and others like it may come with serious health risks. The suit, naming more than two dozen California winemakers, alleges that several inexpensive varieties of wine contain up to five times the amount of arsenic that the Environmental Protection Agency allows in drinking water. About 1,300 bottles of wine of all kinds and price were tested, and just 83 had high arsenic levels. The lower the price of wine, lawsuit sponsor Kevin Hicks tells CBSNews.com, the higher the amount of arsenic. Why would that be? Most of the lower-priced wines are made from grapes grown in California's Central Valley instead of Napa or Sonoma. In the hot valley, they have to be irrigated with a lot of water, which contains arsenic. Winemakers named in the suit say the findings are misleading and accuse Hicks of a conflict of interest because his company tests wines for purity. Since people drink far more water than wine, says a spokesman for the wine group, it would not be accurate or responsible to use the water standard to judge arsenic levels in wine. And on the Talking Points page, German wings crashed, the tortured mind of a suicidal pilot. German wings flight 9525 took off from Barcelona at 10:01 a.m., bound for Dusseldorf, said Mariano Castillo in CNN.com. The plane's captain, Patrick Sodenheimer, hadn't had time to use the bathroom before the flight, so when the plane reached cruising altitude, Sodenheimer left the cockpit to relieve himself. "You can take over," Captain Sodenheimer is heard telling his co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz, on the cockpit's voice recorder. Moments after the door clicks shut, Lubitz directs the plane to rapidly descend from 38,000 feet to 100 feet. Next comes the banging as the locked-out Captain Sodenheimer hammers on the door and begs Lubitz to let him back into the cockpit. "For God's sake, open the door," shouts Sodenheimer, over the sounds of passengers screaming with terror. Minutes later, the plane slams into the French Alps, killing all 150 passengers and crews on board. "What possessed Lubitz to apparently fly the plane into a mountainside?" said Nicholas Kulisch in the New York Times. German investigators are focusing on several clues. Lubitz, 27, had a history of serious depressive episodes and suicidal tendencies, and he may have experienced recent problems with a longtime girlfriend. Discarded notes in his apartment indicate that two doctors recently told him he was unfit to fly, and Lubitz may have feared he would lose the career as a pilot he'd always dreamed of. One flight attendant who says she had an affair with Lubitz told a German newspaper he often woke at night screaming, "We're going down." He once told her, she said, that he would someday do something that will change the entire system, and everyone will know his name. "Don't blame the crash on Lubitz's depression," said Russell Saunders in the DailyBeast.com. "As a doctor, let me tell you this. Depression does not make someone murder 149 people. Indeed, a study of 47,000 people in Sweden found that only 3.7% of men and 0.5% of women diagnosed with depression went on to commit a violent crime. Lubitz's mental illness, whatever it was, led to a monstrous capacity for depraved indifference to the lives of everyone on that plane, including schoolchildren and babies. Some acts are so horrifying, they beggar any attempt to fully comprehend them. A cruel irony enabled Lubitz to carry out his heinous crime, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. After terrorists hijacked planes to commit the 9/11 attacks, commercial airlines fortified the cockpit doors of their aircraft so they were impregnable. Pilots who left the cockpit could only re-enter using a special code, and the person left in the cockpit could override this code if they suspected a potential hijacker was trying to force his way in. When Captain Sodenheimer left the cockpit, Lubitz used this anti-terrorism device to carry out his own form of terrorism, making the passengers belated victims of 9/11. "There's only one way to ensure this doesn't happen again," said William Salatin in Slate.com. "No one should ever be left in the cockpit alone. That policy, already in force in U.S. airliners, doesn't depend on astute shrinks, candid pilots, or perfect technology. It just means that whenever one pilot leaves the cockpit, a second person, a flight attendant or off-duty pilot, steps in until he returns. Fortunately, European airlines are now adopting that rule too." We need our own heads examined if we think that we'll really solve the problem, said Clive Irving in thedailybeast.com. A second person in the cockpit, especially a flight attendant, could quite easily be taken out by a rogue pilot who planned for just such an adversary. Nor would the psychological testing of pilots weed out every potential threat, since they might just lie. You could take humans out of the equation altogether, of course, by putting computerized autopilots in full control of airliners from takeoff to landing. But even after this horrific murder-suicide, no sane person is going to call for the cockpit containing no humans at all. Let's remember that every day, 100,000 commercial flights take off and land without incident all around the world, said James Fallows in TheAtlantic.com. Air travel is incredibly safe. Last year, not a single person died in a commercial crash in the U.S. Most of the recent crashes abroad have involved serious pilot error. And when that error is deliberate, as in the German Wings disaster, it's deeply disturbing. But it's worth resisting the temptation to think that some new regulation or device can offer perfect protection against calculated malice. Unfortunately, none can. And a few short notes. Almost 80% of people who commit a murder-suicide experience a crisis within 2 weeks of the incident, according to data maintained by the Centers for Disease Control. More than 70% of cases involve problems with romantic partners. In 93% of the cases, the perpetrators are men. The top 15 contenders for the Republican presidential nomination own at least 40 guns among them. Only two GOP hopefuls don't own any firearms, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. And we'll finish up with a quote from Joseph Conrad, quoted in the Wall Street Journal. Being a woman is a terribly difficult task, since it consists principally in dealing with men. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.